Small business owners, this one's for you. Chase for Business and iHeart bring you a new podcast series called The Unshakeables. This one-of-a-kind series will shine the spotlight on small business owners like you who faced a do-or-die moment that ultimately made their business what it is today. Learn more at chase.com/business/podcast. Chase, make more of what's yours. Chase Mobile App is available for select mobile devices. Message and data rates may apply. JPMorgan Chase Bank, N.A., member FDIC. Copyright 2024, JPMorgan Chase & Company.
The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. The PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with AI coaching tools and 5G-connected cameras. AAA is getting more drivers back on the road fast with location telematics. And the Las Vegas Grand Prix is powering race day operations with 5G connectivity, giving fans an experience at the speed they deserve. This is accelerating innovation with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
Smart journalism. Fascinating topics. Words that describe CNN's podcast, The Assignment with Audie Cornish.
Last year, the Army missed its recruitment goal. It had 65,000 spots to fill and came up 10,000 short of that target. Why is it so hard to recruit? How's the Pentagon responding? And how are the voices of service members on social media shifting the balance?
Listen to The Assignment with Audie Cornish wherever you get your podcasts.
Pushkin. This is Talk Easy. I'm Sam Fragoso. Welcome to the show. Today, I'm joined by reporter Evan Osnos. Osnos has been a staff writer for The New Yorker since 2008, covering politics and foreign affairs. You may have also seen him on CNN, where he's a regular contributor throughout election season. And that's why I wanted to sit with Evan, especially on the heels of Joe Biden and Donald Trump, securing the required delegates to become their party's nominees. I know for many people listening to this right now, the fact that that sentence is true, that is true again in 2024 as it was in 2020, is deeply upsetting. It's the sequel nobody asked for, a rematch that makes just about everyone I know in my life want to get into a cryo chamber and set the timer to 2028, or at the very least, January 20th, 2025, which is when, in all likelihood, Donald Trump or Joe Biden will be sworn in for a second term. So, with all of that, what do we do with these choices? That's the question that guides this conversation. It's the question that made me want to sit with Evan, because when it comes to Biden, there are few reporters that have had as much access to him as Evan Osnos. In fact, as president, Biden has been historically press averse. He's done less interviews than Obama, Trump, Bush, all of them, by a significant margin. It's not even close. He does not talk to the press, and there are a few reasons for that. But in the last month, Osnos sat with him for a profile in The New Yorker titled The Last Campaign, which is a double entendre of sorts as we consider the fate and future of American democracy. Osnos has also written a pretty uncompromising, incisive book on the 46th president titled Joe Biden, The Life, The Run, and What Matters Now. So in Act One of this episode, we talk about Biden's complicated bid for re-election, where he's succeeded in the last 4 years and where he's fallen painfully short, especially in Gaza. In Act Two, we discuss the alternative in Donald Trump and how he is very much not the Donald Trump of 2020 or 2016. What he plans to do, what Trump and his team plan to do, if granted a second term, is deeply horrifying and is something that Evan outlines pretty thoroughly in this episode. Then, finally, for Act Three, the big, messy, existential questions that I think a lot of us are having about Biden, democracy, the values of this country, and the disillusionment that so many feel in this moment. I talked about this at the top with Evan, but Time Magazine recently ran a piece titled The Dread Election, which is definitely appropriate and funny and depressing, but it's also kind of useless. Because what do we do with dread? Dread flattens us. It paralyzes us. It makes us think we have no options. And I think the way Evan lays it all out, the way he relays his reporting, his knowledge of history, it actually gave me a little bit of hope. Not a lot of hope, not a surplus of hope, but just a little bit. And in 2024, I don't know about you, but that's about as much as I can ask for. And so with that, here is Evan Osnos. Evan Osnos, thank you for being here.
My pleasure, Sim. Thank you for having me.
You have been, covering this election and the political landscape for a while now, but especially the last 4 years. And so I figure I need to start by asking you, are you all right?
That is a decent and generous question, and I think a logical one for anybody covering politics.
That will be my last decent and generous question.
As the Brits would say, I'm bearing up.
What does that mean again?
It means you're kind of stiff upper lipping it. And I do find that I can't do politics too long, too much. I have to break it up by doing other things.
Like coming on Talk Easy and talking about politics?
Easy is the relevant word. I got it. Yes, exactly. Well, this is talking about it is slightly different than staring at the surface of the sun of it. So this is a much better version.
You recently published this excellent profile of Joe Biden, and it was striking for a number of reasons that we'll get into today. But since that interview ran, Biden delivered a pretty, I'll say, animated performance at the State of the Union. He also, along with former President Trump, recently secured the requisite delegates to clinch a nomination from the Democratic Party, setting up a rematch that Time magazine called the Dread Election. And I want to start here as a way to frame this conversation in terms other than dread and despair, which I don't think actually get us anywhere. How would you frame the state and the stakes of this election?
I think that if we start with the stakes, which ultimately is what this should be about, it's a strange moment to be writing about things that are beyond the range of hyperbole, meaning you really can't talk about what this election is about without acknowledging that it is genuinely an election that is about the very future of democracy, which has become the most kind of familiar and banal cliche, except it happens to be true.
Are you saying once again, as pundits have said for the last 20, 30 years, this is the most important election you'll ever vote in?
I would have, but I practically have a post-it note that says, don't ever say this is the most important election of your life. If this thing goes, frankly, into the hands of Donald Trump, it's not entirely clear what happens to our system of elections. And that would sound like a bizarre thing to say in any other race, except that in this particular case, that's just what the facts deliver.
And framing it in that kind of binary, I do think people feel that talking about it is a bit challenging because no one really knows where to go when you say, if Trump wins, we may not have a democracy. And so I want to start with President Biden. You know, you last interviewed him in 2020. I think it's safe to say that the last 4 years have aged all of us quite a bit. But in poll after poll, 70 to 80% of voters are worried about his age. It's been a point of emphasis in the press. It was at the center of special counsel Robert Hur's report on Biden's handling of classified materials, in which he rendered the president a sympathetic, well-meaning elderly man with a poor memory. Having sat down with him in 2020, and then again recently, is that description of Biden in line with your experiences with him?
I'd be lying to you, Sam, if I didn't say that the very first thing on my mind when I walked in to interview him in January of this year was precisely that. Because in some ways, depending on what the answer to that question is, everything else changes. And what I saw when I went into the room this time was a man who is thinner physically, and that includes the sense that he just looks a little more frail. His voice has thinned kind of dramatically, and he clears his throat all the time. But I will tell you that it was pretty clear within a couple of minutes of talking to him that the gears, the cogs in the machine are exactly the same. What I mean is he was doing the same sorts of things that his mind has always done. There was, James Comey, who worked with him in the government before becoming kind of the famous former FBI director, used to say that a conversation with Joe Biden started at point A and ended at point Z. And it went everywhere in between. And it has ever been thus.
And that's a good thing?
I don't know if it's a good thing or not. It's him. It's been him. And it's partly a reflection of his own ideological and intellectual restlessness and intellectual insecurity. Let's call it what it is. This is really, you can't understand this man without knowing where he has always felt a little bit vulnerable. And for that reason, he often filibustered. He would fill the space because if he didn't fill it, then you might. So I think the thing that's noticeable is he doesn't say as much as he used to. He doesn't fill every silence. But I think the key point is that this guy is there. This guy is still there, and he's not different in any of the core competencies that matter, like his decision-making or his, his judgment on issues. And that, I think, is a hard thing for people to accept because he looks and sounds so much older than he was before. And you have to be able to have these two ideas in your head at the same time.
Biden surrogates often tell the press, behind closed doors, you wouldn't believe this man. They all become like Jewish mothers suddenly. They he's a different man. He's alert. He's engaged. He's the best boy. Colleagues praise his energy, his commitment to the job. This has happened so much that SNL did a sketch about Biden's prowess behind closed doors.
Okay, so you feel he's up to the job.
Dana, I was just with him. And behind closed doors, he's a dynamo. This weekend, we both went down to the border town of Brownsville, Texas, and Joe went into beast mode. He said, we gotta tighten this border. Look how easy I can cross it. Then he parkoured up to the top of the border wall. He front flipped into the Rio Grande and came back up with a fish in his mouth. But you didn't report that because it doesn't fit your little narrative.
I need to ask you, why is there such a startling disconnect between Biden behind closed doors and Biden doors slightly ajar?
I think that what's happening is that some of that gap is closing. If you take as an example the State of the Union, the person that you saw at the State of the Union, and I would even say put aside the speech for a second, to the degree that people subjected themselves to watching the State of the Union, and a lot of Americans don't really want to, but if you watched him beforehand, when he walks in the room and he's working himself down the aisle and he's shaking every hand and he's, even the people who hate him, he's chatting with them, and you saw a kind of energy there that I think was probably a little surprising to people. And, we could talk about whether he had a Red Bull or six or whatever it was on the way in, but
I have questions about the regimen that I'm going to ask you about later.
But in a direct answer to your question, Sam, if you want to really know what he's like behind closed doors, read this transcript that just came out recently from the Robert Hur special counsel's interview, because that transcript is actually really one of the clearest descriptions, and it really captures what this man is like, which is to say, he tells a million stories. Some of them are completely unrelated to why he's in this interview with the special counsel. He ties them back in some way, but that's exactly what it's like talking to him. It's not as if this guy is somehow, doing bench presses behind the scenes, and then when he gets out in front of the crowd, he looks like an 81-year-old man. Part of the reason why you see a difference now is that this guy is a lot better when he has the time, the space, the preparation. Like, the State of the Union speech did not happen casually. They went up to Camp David. They rehearsed the hell out of it. They practiced. He puts little breath marks on his script into every word about where he's going to take a breath. Part of that's, it's related to being, you know, the fact that he's a stutterer. But, and if he doesn't do that kind of stuff, Sam, he sounds a lot less good, particularly now at this age. And so one of the lessons, and this is a big blaring thing, is over the next 8 months, they have to figure out a way to give him as much time and space to prepare for big public occasions, because if he doesn't, then he looks much less good. And that is the biggest difference.
I understand that. So I think moving beyond the superficial aspects here, I wanted to talk about the substance of his reelection campaign. He said to you that he's running again because he's, quote, proud of his record. That's a record that includes the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act, the Inflation Reduction Act, the CHIPS and Science Act that will make this coming decade one of infrastructure and invention, as Ezra Klein wrote, a decade of building, of decarbonizing, of researching. They expanded the Affordable Care Act, in which 21 million people signed up last year. They took the first steps towards letting Medicare negotiate drug prices. They took steps towards student loan forgiveness. They've taken steps to decriminalize nonviolent offenses. And when it comes to the violent crime, it has dropped to nearly a 50-year low. Unemployment is below 4%. The S&P and the Dow hit record highs. They averted a recession that basically every respected economist predicted would happen. And we are still seeing strong wage gains for the poorest Americans. Inequality is down, growth is quick, and the country is producing more energy than at any previous moment in its history. I could go on and on, but it really doesn't matter, because every accomplishment I've just outlined has had, to this point, no meaningful impact on any major poll. It has not changed how people feel about Biden, and it has not inspired enthusiasm in a second term. So my two questions to you are, why do you think that is? And secondly, how does the Biden administration plan to combat this tendency for good news to fall on deaf ears?
So if you take what is this extraordinary record that you just described and you put it into the context of this moment, you have to first begin with the fact that people more broadly, whether it's Joe Biden or other politicians, the public is completely sick of politics. At the end of the Trump era, people had been forced, in a sense, to deal with politics in their brains every day, day in and day out, that there was just a measurable drop off in the amount that people wanted to care about politics. They didn't want to have to talk about it with their friends. They'd lost friends over the course of the last few years. So that's one thing that's happening, is that that list of things, which by any measurement would have usually registered in people's approval ratings, a lot of people, frankly, just didn't pay all that much attention.
So basically, once Trump lost, their interest was in a kind of like remission.
Yes, exactly. And I think, honestly, I mean, you could have had Taylor Swift in the presidency and probably she would have been a little bit unpopular after a while because people were just sick of politics.
She would have had better polling numbers than Biden, but yes.
And she would have had a better way of getting out of it, that's for sure. I think there's two other things that are going on. We are, as a country right now, in a midst of not just a psychic funk, I mean, a kind of a degree of, whether it's like informal mental health terms, but just as a country, our level of dissatisfaction with the direction of the place is profound. And then on top of that, half of the country is not talking to the other half. It's almost exactly half. And so as a result, the people who might be inclined to, if you're a Republican and you might be inclined to say, I'm pretty happy that my stock portfolio has never been better because the S&P just broke records, or you might be happy that if you're on the left, you might be happy to find that in fact more people have health care than ever in American history, or that, you know, they just passed this big climate bill, the largest climate bill in American history. The fact is that in each half, there is a group of people who will simply never want to say that Joe Biden, the centrist of centrists, is my guy, means that he has a kind of ceiling on his natural support. I think the other huge factor here, that until very recently, I mean, Joe Biden just clinched the nomination just very recently. Until that point, a lot of Americans, honestly, and the data supports this, didn't really accept the fact that it was going to be a choice between Biden and Trump. the campaign internally estimates it's about 25% of Americans in swing states who fully engaged that fact.
They couldn't believe that we would have to run it back.
That's right. It just felt unbearable. And for that reason, when you asked people about how you feel about Joe Biden, a lot of times the answer was terrible. And, you know, it was one commentator who called it referred pain, meaning everything of the last few years, the pandemic, inflation, just the sort of dyspepsia with the state of the country. You put all that together and it attaches to the incumbent. Now, none of that is an exoneration. None of that is, I don't say any of that is intended to sort of, you know, say that it's not his fault or his problem. All I'm saying is that when you're trying to understand these numbers right now, and perhaps more importantly, when Joe Biden is looking at these numbers and trying to figure out, am I going to lose this race? Part of his answer is, I don't think the race has really begun yet. And we're just in the moment now of people tuning in.
I'd say on the left, it has certainly begun, and it has especially begun since October 7th of last year. Since then, I've heard from many people on the left that as this crisis in Gaza goes on, that they don't feel comfortable reelecting an administration that continues to offer military aid to Israel, that is presiding over 30,000 plus Palestinians dead, 70% of whom are women and children. When you spoke to Biden recently, did he view this issue as the existential crisis it very much appears to be in this moment?
Yeah, I have to tell you, this was the one point in my interview with him where this kind of somewhat blustery, very confident, I've got no problems attitude collapsed. Honestly, Sam, I mean, this was the moment when I could see he knows how politics works. He knows when something is a profound issue and when something is a short-term issue that he can manage. Physically, I saw him kind of sink when I raised this question of, what are you saying? What can you say, particularly to young Democrats, to people of color, to Arab Americans, Muslim Americans who say that they have lost faith in you? And the reason why I think he almost shrank in that moment was that he does not have an easy answer for that question. First thing he said was, of course, we do not want to see Palestinians dying by the thousands. This is not, he said, the way he put it was, it's un-American to imagine that. Then, of course, he said, but I also ask them for patience. As I heard that, I thought to myself, there are very few people who are going to hear that, his critics, who are going to say, well, that's a solution because this is an urgent, ongoing emergency. How is patience a solution to the problem?
By the way, a patience and a time not afforded to people who are in Gaza right now.
But you have to consider also the position he's in. You know, the United States, for as long as Joe Biden has been alive, has supported the state of Israel from its origins. You know, Joe Biden has been alive longer than the state of Israel has existed.
A man born in 1942.
Yeah, exactly. And I think for him, he is tugged between these two impulses. One, to say, I can never relinquish my support for the state of Israel as an idea, as a refuge for Jews in the world, without which he deeply believes they would not be safe. And at the same time, he's had this 50-year, very tense and often angry relationship with Bibi Netanyahu. And I think if there was an obvious mistake that he made in this process, it was going to Israel and putting his arms around Bibi Netanyahu. I mean, he did it at a moment when it felt like at the time he was doing it as a gesture of solace. And in the end, it attached himself. He attached himself to a man who, for one thing, doesn't see the world the way that Biden does, and two, doesn't really want him to win again. I mean, Bibi Netanyahu wants Donald Trump to win again. And that's because Donald Trump, let's remember, does not exactly have the Palestinians' best interest at heart.
I want to hold that moment that you were describing, though, as both a reporter, but also as a person in the room sitting right across from him. You said it was the only time in your interview where he seemed to break character, where the bluster subsided, he slunk down in his seat. I wonder, do you think he felt deflated about the actions or the inaction that he's taken? Or was he more horrified by the prospect that this may cost him an election.
Now, I got the sense that it is about the dilemma, the predicament, the fact that he is in a moment of anguish. And look, you have to think about how he perceives himself. You know, I know this is hard to imagine for people who now see him as somebody who is, in effect, helping Bibi Netanyahu do what he is doing. But that's not Joe Biden's self-image. You know, he's a person who's been calling for a two-state solution for years, long after it was out of fashion in politics in this country and in Israel. And now he finds himself in the position where he's the guy in the seat at the very moment when that is both necessary and politically impossible. So I think that's what it was about. Look, if he was so concerned that losing the election was an immediate risk, he wouldn't be running. The numbers are pretty clear. He thinks that he can probably turn this around. I think he's kind of, and we can have a whole debate about whether that's delusional or rational.
I think it's clear that his capacity to be delusional, to believe in himself, has got him here. But if he does somehow manage to address and connect to those voters, I'm thinking about the Arab American and Muslim voters in Michigan that put in protest votes in the primary. If he does manage to connect to those younger voters, or people that are not just younger, but feel strongly about this issue, I want to get to this one last bit here, which is that in 2020, he positioned himself as the transition candidate, the bridge to the next generation. I just want to take a look at what that sounded like in 2020 for a second.
So folks, it's time for America to get back up and once again fight for the proposition that we hold these truths self-evident, that fight for the notion that America has to lead the world and lead Americans to this new place, this new generation. Look, I view myself as a bridge, not as anything else. There's an entire generation of leaders you saw stand behind me. They are the future of this country.
So here we are 4 years later. Does he still see himself in those transitional terms?
I think that, to state the obvious, everybody assumed when he said that he was going to be a transition or a bridge, people thought that meant that he was only going to serve one term, right? That's what the general perception was. At the time, there was a little bit of what's known in foreign policy as strategic ambiguity, meaning he never said he was only going to do one term.
When you interviewed him 4 years ago, did you believe that?
No, honestly, and that might sound convenient after the fact, but the reality is it'd be nuts to say before the fact that you're only going to serve one term, because if you do that, then every reporter in the world is just going to spend your entire first term talking about who's going to be your successor, is Kamala going to outplay so-and-so, and it would probably undermine your ability to do anything in Congress because they wouldn't work with you at all. So there's a way in which he was trying to have his cake and eat it too. He wanted to indicate, okay, I'm not going to be around forever, but at the same time, not hobble himself by committing himself to a four-year term. And so that's what they came up with, was this kind of transition language. When he talks about being a bridge or a transition, that's true after 8 years as it is after four. But I'm also, let's be blunt about something. I think there was something that changed in his mind. This is me speculating. I didn't ask this precisely, but I think at the point at which Donald Trump tried to steal the election from Joe Biden,
a man who said that he wanted to be president since the age of 21, 22.
I think that when this happened, there was a degree to which it kind of set off a piece of Biden that is competitive and proud and demands, in a sense, that he respond to the insult that Donald Trump represents, not just to him personally, but to everything the guy stands for. And on some level, you know, because I asked him this question in the interview, I said, was there ever a moment in the course of this first term when you thought that you might not run again? And he immediately said no. What that clearly indicates is by the time he arrived in this job, he was pretty sure that he was going to run for a second term. And you can regard that as hypocrisy or renouncing an earlier pledge. You know, he would say, well, listen closely to what I said. I never said I was going to only do 4 years. I think it's a combination of all of those factors.
He contends that he's still best positioned to beat Trump because he beat him before.
Yeah. And I think that there are a few things that matter. One is that it's not just a Biden talking point to say that there are not other people out there who have beaten Trump. It's a really specific bit of political chemistry to beat this guy who has very high name recognition, who has this concatenation of all of these different constituencies, most importantly, after all, the white working class, who has this record in the upper Middle West. Like, all of that matters. And Gavin Newsom, just to give you one example, polls about 10 points behind Joe Biden compared to Donald Trump. So if you are imagine, and that applies really to most of the big names. I can't say that everybody fits into that particular arrangement, but that's pretty much what happens when you start looking at people who are often talked about. So you're in this odd position where Biden is both polling behind and is also one of the only people who has the raw political elements at this point to be able to say, I really have shown a path to beating this guy.
So he really wants the sequel, is basically what you're telling me.
Yeah, which I find somewhat mystifying sometimes, honestly, Sam. I mean, I sort of look at it, I think you could, you know, retire at this point and you would go down in history as having taken America out of the pandemic and vanquished Trump, driven him from the White House. And the fact that he doesn't do that is where it becomes as much of a kind of, I think, a story about his own personal psychology and his notion of his read of the politics. I've been doing this for a while now, and if there's one thing I've learned about covering politics is that it is a whole lot harder to win elections than you might think it is from the outside. And God knows I've been wrong over and over again about trying to estimate who's going to win and who's going to lose.
Well, I certainly don't underestimate how hard it is. And I think he is hoping that his sequel is more like Godfather 2 than Speed 2. And I wish him and all of us the best. In terms of the psychology of Biden, I want to get to that a little bit at the end. Because, you know, growing up, Biden's father would often say to him, Joey, don't compare me to the Almighty. Compare me to the alternative. Which is a line Biden has used in talking to voters about Trump. And, you know, for the last 4 years, I think many people have been able to, at least to some degree, tune out of Trump TV, which I think was healthy for a time, but is perhaps not prudent in 2024. So with that, Trump held his first big rally of the campaign in Waco, Texas. What was the historical significance of kicking off his campaign there?
Yeah, it's kind of an amazing symbol. In Waco, Texas is this iconic place in the history of the far right movement in America, because in 1993, 30 years ago, so this was in effect the 30th anniversary, there was a cult called the Branch Davidians that was stockpiling weapons, and they came under siege from federal agents. There were children inside this compound. The federal government was basically saying, we're going to try to shut this cult down. And the building went up in flames, and dozens of people died. And it became this moment that became a real touchstone for militia movements and people who ended up becoming the forerunners of the Alex Jones and other far-right figures of today. To have a Republican candidate for president start his first public rally in Waco, Texas, is the kind of thing, Sam, that if you had told me that 10 years ago, I would have said that's completely nuts, never going to happen. And it is a real measure of where Donald Trump is and who he is seeking to connect with that he did that.
That he chose that place as the bedrock. What do you think that portends?
What it portends is that he is running, in effect, as an anti-government figure. I mean, it's a crazy thing. Here we have the Republican nominee for president who is draping himself in all of the aesthetics of the far-right anti-government movements, the people who stormed the Capitol on January 6th. At that rally, they played the national anthem as sung by, it was members of the January 6th insurrection who recorded it in prison, and they played it at this rally, and Donald Trump is standing there with his hand over his heart.
How did that work exactly?
a number of the people who were locked up after January 6th for participating in storming the Capitol, they ended up kind of singing a version of the national anthem into a phone in jail. And then Trump seized on this and decided it was going to be the anthem of his campaign, in effect. And so here you have a guy running for president, and the national anthem at his rally is being sung by people in jail for people who are under arrest for having stormed the Capitol on January 6th. We have never had a moment like this in modern American politics, just absolutely never. The reason why I highlighted that, why I think that's so important, is I think a lot of people just kind of shrugged when that happened, to the degree that we were even paying attention to politics. People might have seen a newspaper story and been like, well, that's Trump being Trump. And no, I think you have to account for how truly aberrant that is and what it really portends for the country.
I want to focus on the distinctions between Trump being Trump in 2016 and Trump being Trump in 2024 and beyond, because I think you're right. I think there's a conflation that's happened. In your book, Wildland, you wrote extensively about how Trump cultivated what you called the combat mindset, which has a focus on self-reliance. What exactly did that look like in the Trump presidency, and how do you think it manifests in 2024?
Yeah, in 2016, he tapped into this political vein of opportunity, which was essentially it's the pro-gun crowd. And as we all know, I mean, that is beyond just people who are gun owners. It's people who sort of talk about the Second Amendment like it's their primary political identity. And what he realized was those people are in play, meaning I can activate them. I can get them to see me as their savior. And so it became this much larger idea than just gun rights. Yes, I mean, I watched him go give this speech at the National Rifle Association convention, and I realized there is a fusion going on between his control of the Republican world and this, what is in many cases, a kind of latent anti-government spirit. And he put these two things together and it was very powerful.
He calls himself their retribution.
And in a way, so much about our politics now is driven by a sense of who has power and who is depriving me of power. And that applies across the board. And I think you captured something really important a moment ago, Sam, when you described how he has moved from the 2016 Trump to the 2024 Trump. In 2016, remember, it's almost easy to forget this now, he was a guy who had been on reality television. He had this weird kind of vestigial celebrity from being on The Apprentice. People didn't know what his policies were. People didn't take him seriously. And then when he started saying all of this really nasty anti-immigrant white nationalist stuff, frankly, a lot of people in the mainstream press, I think, made a terrible mistake by treating him as a joke. And I think it was pretty clear from early on what was happening, but it took people way too long to realize the threat that he posed. But today, he no longer is trying, in a sense, to sort of imitate a conventional politician. He's abandoned that. What he's doing now is actively running, in effect, as somebody who is seeking to undo politics as we know it, and to undo actually government as we know it. That is not an exaggeration. And you have to reckon, if you look at the things he's talking about doing, whether it's taking control of the Justice Department as a tool of political retribution, or laying off 40 or 50,000 civil servants and replacing them with people who would be loyal to him. You know, I've worked and lived in authoritarian countries, in China, in Egypt. That's how it goes. That's what happens. That's how a system becomes actually an extension of a person, of a man. And you really can't overstate how grave that threat is.
You've equated Trump's White House to, quote, Emerald City, fortified against non-believers, entranced by its myth maker, and constantly vulnerable to the risks of reality. For those that are maybe unfamiliar with those plans that you just talked about, when you look at Project 2025, which is centered around this unitary executive theory, how would that differ from the Emerald City he presided over in his first term? What does that look like?
So Project 2025 is, in a sense, a preview of what Donald Trump intends to do as president. It's a group of his advisors and his loyalists, some of whom were involved in the January 6th insurrection, people like Jeffrey Clark, who was a Justice Department official, that, you know, they are basically saying this is what we need to do in order to restructure the government to allow us to take command. So things like the ability to direct the Justice Department to prosecute people who they think are their political enemies. I mean, I know that we sometimes imagine, well, the attorney general is, after all, appointed by the president, so maybe he is loyal. But no, all you got to do is look at the fact that right now you have an attorney general who has appointed a special counsel to investigate Joe Biden's, you know, classified document handling, or you've got Hunter Biden, the president's son, who's being investigated.
A special counsel that has admitted on the record to being a Republican.
Yeah, he's a registered Republican. So that is the current state of play. That's how a government actually functions in our system. It's designed to have this intra-competition between agencies. Donald Trump and his people want to get rid of that. This idea of the unitary executive is this theory of the presidency, which basically says the founders got it wrong. You know, remember, the founders, after all, were trying to avoid the recreation of a king. And so everything that they did was actually to shrink the presidency. It's kind of amazing. I mean, I was going back recently and looking at this. You know, the presidency, as it was first conceived in this country, was such a minimal office that it was James Polk's wife who came up with the idea of having the band play Hail to the Chief when the president walked into the room, because otherwise he was kind of a forgettable guy. People would just sort of carry on what they were doing. And so this period, Donald Trump's movement, and you have to call it that, is about trying to create a presidency that is immune to the oversight and the powers, the checks and balances of other branches of government. And, you know, the best preview of what Donald Trump's government would be like if he wins this election is basically how he responded to the pandemic. You remember when the pandemic happens, there is pretty clear evidence coming in that this thing is going to be a very serious risk to people's health. And that was inconvenient for Trump. I mean, that was like, he didn't want it to interfere with business. And so, as you remember, you know, so he's telling us to put whatever bleach in our veins and telling us it's all going to get better and everything's going to be okay. And Jared Kushner's telling us everything's going to be fine and we're rounding the curve.
You didn't put bleach in your veins?
Still do. Still going. It's hard habit to break, Sam, you know?
I thought I noticed something when I saw you on CNN yesterday.
It just feels so clean from the inside out.
Your wife too? Does she do that?
Oh, it's a whole family affair. We just get together for a big bleach off. I really do think, I mean, honestly, as I find myself talking about it, I almost get heart palpitations.
Please don't. We're not insured.
Yeah. I didn't sign anything when we started this interview. I hope you're taking full responsibility for the for the reminding me of this.
I'm going to pass it off to Remnick. So.
Well, there we are. I mean, there's something going on that's weird, which is like, for all of the trauma, and that's a big word, but it's the right word, that Trump imposed on us over that period, I think just as a coping mechanism, we all have sort of pushed it into the back of our minds. And it's easy to be like, ah, well, politicians are all pretty lousy. I don't want to have to think about it. And I think over the course of the next few months, we're going to get a pretty vibrant and pungent reminder of what a Donald Trump presidency would be like.
I think the key difference is, I mean, he's already previewed this Project 2025 plan, but he's also publicly aligned himself with several autocrats. I mean, Russia's Vladimir Putin, who he encouraged to, quote, do whatever the hell they want to any NATO member country that doesn't meet spending guidelines on defense. Just recently, he hosted Hungary's Viktor Orban in Mar-a-Lago and praised him as, quote, a boss that gets things done. Never mind that those things include restrictions on immigration, LGBTQ plus rights, and crackdowns on the free press. Biden contends in your profile that the American press has become immune to Trump, that they've become numb to his autocratic overtures. Do you think that's true, or do you think the numbness extends to the electorate as well, and that this may be a chicken and the egg scenario?
That's an important point. I think there is a way in which the public has come to see Trump as this independent category of person, where it's almost as if nothing that he does shocks us. And as a result, we all make these minor adjustments all the time just to kind of get through the experience of knowing that he is there, to just kind of say, well, that's this guy, Trump. When the reality is that individually, just take as an example, the fact that he is surrounding himself with somebody like Stephen Miller, who was, after all, the architect of some of the most brutal anti-immigration policies that we've had in this country in the last century. I mean, a lot of Americans, Sam, I think, spent the last 3 years just forgetting about the existence of somebody like Stephen Miller, because we have to live our lives. Like, we have to be people. And it's not as if that guy went away. In fact, he has built up more power.
Right.
And the idea is that if they came back in, that they would actually know how to operate the levers of government. And that this time, the things that they tried to do last time, which were stymied by the checks and balances and the federal system, would be a lot easier for them to accomplish. Things like setting up deportation forces to bring people from the interior of the country and send them across the border. It's the kind of thing that I think, like it or not, we have to come face to face with as what the choice is about here.
And thinking about what a 2025 Trump presidency would look like, I'm trying to hold both the State of the Union and your interview with Biden, where he was quick to warn voters of what could come if Trump was reelected, especially in the courts, where Justice Clarence Thomas argued in his decision on Dobbs that the legal rationale for overturning Roe could be applied to, quote, correct the error in cases of same-sex marriage, the decriminalization of homosexuality, and access to contraception. Do you believe those would be the goals of a second Trump term? And more broadly, talk about the gap between the organizational prowess that they had in 2016 when they were elected and what they would have in terms of infrastructure in 2025.
Yeah, this is not abstract. The idea of dismantling rights like access to contraception or protection of same-sex marriage are things that Clarence Thomas has explicitly described as the natural logical outcome of the Dobbs decision, that that laid the predicate, basically, for then going after these things. And if you didn't think that that's possible, well, then you probably never thought it was possible to dismantle Roe v. Wade. These things are entirely destructible from the perspective of the conservative majority of the Supreme Court. And that gets to your important point, which is when Donald Trump came in 2016, they did not yet have the level of control that they have over the Supreme Court today. They did not have a system of federal judges at lower courts that are operating, in a sense, in concert together to try to create the conditions that would produce a decision like that that could have a profound reversion of our rights in this country. And in a way, the process is much further along now. And they know what the system is capable of stopping, and therefore they're better at being able to work around it. You know, Sam, one of the biggest mistakes, analytical mistakes that I've made in my life was coming to believe that there were certain kinds of progress that were irreversible, that I just did not believe that you could wrench the clock back in time in the ways that we have. And I think that was a kind of naivete. It was just a basic belief. And this applies to China, where I lived for a long time. It applies to the United States. And I've kind of had to come to terms. One of the sort of wages of maturity is realizing, oh, actually, there are people in power who do really want to drive this country back into the past. And I'm coming to terms with that.
It seems to me that disbelief, that naivete, it was very much, in retrospect, the animating feature of the 2016 election. I think there were a lot of people who thought, we had two terms of Obama.
Yes.
There were people who believed that we were in some kind of, quote, post-racial society, which never made any sense to anyone who's ever studied history, who's ever talked to communities of color. No one believed that except for white people for the most part.
Agree.
And there was a general belief that a man who was on The Apprentice, a man whose policies could not really be defined in 2016, couldn't possibly beat a woman as qualified as Secretary Clinton. And it was because of that naivete and that disbelief that I think delivered 4 years of not only abject pain, but policies that we are going to have to live with and through till God knows when.
And I would add one thing, which is I think that even for people who didn't believe in the kind of fallacy of a post-racial America, which I think even if you never believed that, which really was a fantasy, then you still believed on some level that there were things that were enshrined in law, there were things that were parts of the way the government worked that would be very hard to dismantle or roll back. And I think that we are kind of coming to the reality that we actually have more agency than we think we did. This is it's a bit of a counterintuitive conclusion, Sam, and I think it's one that's really important, which is that part of what happened in 2016 was people felt like, okay, the march of time is moving in this direction. As Obama would say, it kind of zigs and it zags. We may go backwards at some moments and forwards at others. But also on top of it, what real impact can I have? I mean, look, these two candidates, people didn't like Hillary Clinton and they didn't like Donald Trump. So really, what impact could I have? That was wrong, actually. Like, you have huge impact. And I think that in some ways, that level of agency is lurking right beyond the horizon of this moment, because that really is what this thing is going to come down to. It is honestly going to come down to whether or not people feel as if they have a consequential voice in the outcome. And if they believe they do not, then curiously enough, they will have that choice made for them. And that is a challenge, honestly, for people who care about and who I think are thinking about the stakes of this election, is to make the case to people that it is not an overstatement to say that every person on this question has genuine agency.
After the break, a lightning round with Evan Osnos and how we should be thinking about the 2024 election. Stay with us.
Small business owners, this one's for you. Chase for Business and iHeart bring you a new podcast series called The Unshakeables. This one-of-a-kind series will shine the spotlight on small business owners like you who faced a do-or-die moment that ultimately made their business what it is today. Join hosts Ben Walter, CEO of Chase for Business, and Tanya Nebo, a lawyer and business consultant, on these storytelling journeys of trials, tribulations, and triumphs that hinged on a single event, a split-second decision, or even a stroke of luck. Whether the story is about a warehouse going up in flames or a former partner stealing a whole roster of clients, each episode will showcase the grit, determination, and resourcefulness a small business owner needed to turn a pivotal situation into a springboard for success. Listen to The Unshakeables now and learn more at chase.com/business/podcast. Chase. Make more of what's yours. Chase Mobile App is available for select mobile devices. Message and data rates may apply. JPMorgan Chase Bank, N.A., member FDIC. Copyright 2024, JPMorgan Chase & Company.
The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. The PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with AI coaching tools and 5G-connected cameras. AAA is getting more drivers back on the road fast with location telematics. And the Las Vegas Grand Prix is powering race day operations with 5G connectivity, giving fans an experience at the speed they deserve. This is accelerating innovation with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
Smart journalism, fascinating topics, words that describe CNN's podcast, The Assignment with Audie Cornish.
Last year, the Army missed its recruitment goal. It had 65,000 spots to fill and came up 10,000 short of that target. Why is it so hard to recruit? How's the Pentagon responding? And how are the voices of service members on social media shifting the balance?
Listen to The Assignment with Audie Cornish wherever you get your podcasts.
Trump has 91 charges against him across 4 criminal court cases. I want to ask some broad top-of-mind questions that people maybe don't have the answers to. If he's convicted in any of the 4 cases, can he still be president?
Yes, which should blow your mind, but it is a fact. It's like a little bit of a loophole that the people who wrote the Constitution didn't think they'd have to worry about. They sort of figured...
A little bit?
they figured that we, in our infinite wisdom, would probably not elect somebody who was actually a felon. Yeah, he can still take the presidency.
Will any of the court cases be resolved by November?
The answer is partially, meaning that probably none of these cases will be fully adjudicated. He'll still be appealing things. And in fact, there may not even be an early verdict in any of them. But that is a genuine issue in flux because these court cases are all moving around. Judges do things at various moments. You know, just even in the last couple of days, there's been huge changes in the Georgia case. If I was a betting person, I would say he will probably get to November without having a verdict in any of these cases. And that's just a hugely important fact because it means that people will be voting without actually knowing if he's going to be a convicted felon.
For those completely disillusioned with both parties, now there's been a lot of talk about voting third party, whether that's RFK and Robert Kennedy, Dr. Cornel West, Jill Stein, the list goes on. Do any of them have any real impact on the election?
Yes, they have actually a big impact on the election. I mean, this is probably, if you were identifying the factors that could tip it either to Biden or Trump, third parties are a huge piece of it. None of the third party candidates are going to win, obviously. They're not going to be president. But over time, the share of third party votes has, in many cases, actually determined the outcome of the election. I mean, just to give you a prime example, in 1992, 19% of the vote went to Ross Perot. 19%, huge amount of the vote. And as a result, George H.W. Bush lost the election. That's basically the interpretation. In 2000, Ralph Nader was the RFK of his time, and basically he elected George W. Bush president. I know that's an unhappy fact for people who loved Ralph Nader, but it's also just a fact, and it's come to be understood as a historical matter. So yeah, there's a huge effort now on the part of even people who don't particularly like Joe Biden, but people who really don't like Donald Trump, to try to discourage people from voting for a third party candidate because the danger is not abstract, that it could, in crucial states like Michigan, like Pennsylvania, like Arizona, that it could end up actually giving Donald Trump the decisive win.
Do you believe RFK pulls more from Biden than Trump?
I don't think we know at this point. I think probably. The truth is that incumbents, historically, going back to the Civil War, have been hurt more by third-party candidates than challengers have. So it's less about what RFK stands for. That almost is immaterial. It's really about the fact that third-party candidates run by saying, these two guys are both terrible, and therefore you should vote for me as a protest, because I'm not going to win, but I will be a way of signifying your voice. So the result is that if you vote for RFK, you are pulling votes away from Joe Biden.
For people listening, they may have seen in the news, RFK is considering Jets quarterback Aaron Rodgers for vice president.
Because of his long history on foreign policy and national security matters? Or I'm sorry, I don't...
Yes, or for his short history not playing quarterback for the Jets. Can you confirm that that's not just a headline they ran on The Onion?
Yeah. I'm sorry to report that we are actually alive and living through this moment in American political history.
So Trump and Biden have the requisite delegates to be the nominees. Will the two ever debate on stage?
They might. This is a genuine open question. I think Donald Trump, of course, did not debate. He wasn't willing to debate against any of the Republican candidates in the primary. And Joe Biden doesn't seem eager to debate Donald Trump. And I think there's probably a few reasons for that. One is you just don't know what Trump's going to do. He's probably going to try to do something weird to throw off the system. And then also, of course, there's the risk that Biden could do something that would reignite this conversation about, is he too old to be able to do the job? So there are a lot of reasons why it may not happen. There's also a side of Biden and I think his campaign that says, look, do we really have to go and debate a guy who's facing 91 felony counts and is like a demonstrated misogynist and a proven rapist? Like, what are we doing here? Why do we have to do that? It's not as if people don't know who Donald Trump is.
But if he doesn't debate Trump and Trump says, I want to, wouldn't the response then be, if he doesn't, oh, he's too old to debate him? That would be a more damning proposition, because then not only is he not equipped to run the country, he's not even equipped to debate that he should run the country.
Well, I think it depends on how he decides to explain what his choice is. And I genuinely don't know. He might debate. It's possible that he will explain why he's choosing not to do it in a way that people find persuasive. Look, the State of the Union was a surprise to a lot of people that he was as specific and energetic as he was. And I think this is really like the big open question, Sam, is like, are we going to see more Biden over the course of the next 8 months that people say to themselves, okay, I don't agree with this man on everything. God knows I disagree with him on policies like his handling of Israel and Gaza. But ultimately, this is not an impressionistic pie in the sky choice. This is a choice between two people, two very specific and real people, Joe Biden and Donald Trump. And so if you're sufficiently bothered by the fact that he's deciding not to debate, maybe because he's too old to do it, well, then you have to decide, what is the outcome of that? What are the second and third order consequences of my choice?
If Trump wins, does Biden contest the results?
No, I don't think so. Unless he really believes that there is a way in which it's been damaged by some sort of interference. Joe Biden is also completely convinced and preparing for the fact that Donald Trump will contest the result. And we know what that looked like last time. That was people physically storming the Capitol. And I said, what do you think happens this time? You know what happened last time. And he said, everything that happened last time plus. I didn't put that in the article, but that is what he said. Meaning, if you thought there was violence last time, we need to be prepared for the very real fact that a man who started his campaign with a public rally at Waco, Texas, site of an anti-government movement, is prepared to do, as Joe Biden would say, just about anything to avoid losing again.
The fact that you didn't include that bit in the article, now that I'm hearing it and holding it, it's unnerving.
It should be, honestly. I mean, I came out of there with a pretty chilling sense that we think we've lived through a period of sometimes unimaginable politics when violence and politics have become linked, and to realize actually that it's not over. In fact, we're living in the preamble of something right now is a terrifying fact, but it's not one that we have the luxury of looking away from. I have to say, I mean, Biden said as I was leaving the room at the end of this interview, he said, I have absolutely, said it twice. He said, losers who are losers are never graceful. And I have absolutely no illusions. This is my paraphrase now. He has no illusions that Donald Trump is going to do anything but contest this race no matter what happens, win or lose. And that's a pretty chilling fact.
I think it is worrying, as you said, to imagine that. And to imagine that future of a Trump presidency, which we've tried to game out a little bit. But I said in the beginning that we'd have to talk about Biden's psychology and something I wanted to wait to talk about towards the end. Because, you know, at this point, every poll has Trump beating Biden between 4 and 7 points. If you contrast that with 2020, Biden never trailed Trump in any major poll. But as you said, Biden has long been a politician to defy the odds, leaning into what writer Richard Ben Cramer described as a kind of vision in his book, What It Takes. I just want to read a section from that. This is how he described Biden in 1987 when he first ran for president. He said, in the end, when you took it apart, it all rested on Joe's certainty. He tried to tell his experts and gurus he had to see the moves. He wanted to play them out in his head with scenes, with dialogue, until he had worked them, refined them, rehearsed every line, until he was sure what would happen. Once he'd seen, then it was singing in his head, and he didn't have to think, he just did. He knew what was supposed to happen. Hell, it was a done deal. And then it wasn't imagination or even balls. No, not to Joe Biden. It was destiny. And so there's a calculus that he has been doing for a long time in imagining his place in the White House, where he can see it. And I'm wondering, as we sit here, what can Biden see in this moment that so many of us cannot?
You know, he calls it gaming it out. To imagine that He can see a lane that others can't see. He can see a route. The route that he sees now, reality of Donald Trump, the unbearable fact of the idea of Trump coming back to politics, begins to loom larger and more concretely in people's minds. And over the course of the next few months, as Joe Biden would imagine it, people come to terms with the thing that his father always used to say, which is, don't compare me to the Almighty, compare me to the alternative. This is not a referendum on Joe Biden. It's not just about how you feel about him. It is ultimately about, do you want category A or do you want category B? Which vision of the United States is the one that makes sense to you? Is it one in which there is a deportation force that is taking immigrants from the interior of the country and ejecting them? Is it a country that is imagining rolling back access to contraception and same-sex marriage? Or is it this other thing? Most elections, for all of the months and money that's spent, it comes down to like the last 3 weeks. People make absolutely vital choices in those last 3 weeks. If you had looked at a poll of Wisconsin and Michigan in 2016 that was taken 3 weeks before Election Day, it looked like Hillary Clinton was going to win those states. But people made choices in those last weeks, whether to stay home and not vote for either one of them because they didn't like them, or in some cases to vote for Trump. So Joe Biden's belief is that there are people out there who are frustrated now with a whole lot in the world. They're frustrated about Gaza. They're frustrated about their lives not being where they wanted them to be right now because of a whole variety of factors. And they put those on the shoulders of the president, as they should. But come November, he's not just the president. He's also the alternative to Donald Trump. One of the things we started with today is that when you ask Biden why he's running again, what he says is, in effect, I've earned this because I've passed legislation that I think is the right thing to do for this country. You know, he's done things like a climate bill, like nothing we've ever had in this country, an infrastructure bill, which, by the way, includes a clean energy bill that on its own would be the largest clean energy investments we've ever had. That's just the infrastructure bill. That's not, on some level, he's a proud man. And he looks at those things and he says, if I wasn't 81, nobody would be disputing me running for reelection.
But he is 81.
He is. But you have to remember, he got into politics when he was really young. And some of us, when you are imprinted with a self-image, it's very hard to relinquish that. And he, in his mind, is a lot younger than the rest of us see him to be.
I'm glad you mentioned this, because it's exactly where I wanted to go. You're right. This is a man who was elected to the Senate at the age of 29, right?
Yeah.
And this is tough territory to enter, but I think we have to, because I think it's on the minds of people. In your reporting, both in this profile and in your book on Biden, this is a man who, by your description and others, fears that if he stops working, he may not be around much longer. In the profile, you write, in Biden's case, he's been in politics so long that one of his aides told me a decade ago, this is a decade ago, that he seemed, quote, afraid if he stops working, he might just fall over.
Yeah.
In the book that you wrote on him, he said one of his aides told me that Biden saw himself as, quote, the shark that has to keep swimming to stay alive.
Yeah.
Mortality, I mean, an ever-present topic of this podcast.
It is an indelible feature of being alive. So I think it speaks well of the podcast that you return to this subject.
Most podcast hosts seem to sidestep it and talk about something else. I seem to always come back to it.
It's the final question in so many respects. Go on.
It may very well be our final question, which is, how much of his decision to run again is informed by his father, who Biden himself encouraged to retire way back when? A decision he has since claimed to deeply regret, telling his father to retire. How much of his bid is a traumatic response to a mistake he believed he made?
I think it is unmistakably a piece of his psychology. I in some ways, one of the things that we do that actually obscures our ability to understand politics is that we start to see these people in one-dimensional terms. And look, that's politics forces us into that. You know, we get kind of one-word shorthand for these people. But they are people. They're human beings with all of the psychological complexity that goes along with that. And in some ways, there's a reason why I have referenced this multiple times in my writing about Biden. He has been active as a political person, a public man, as he uses that phrase, for so long that I think he cannot really imagine what it's like to stop. He's a person who is so addicted to contact with other human beings that one of his aides years ago told me that at the end of a rally, like after he'd been out shaking hands, talking to human beings all day long, he'd get home to his hotel room and he'd have to watch like two movies before he could fall asleep because he was so amped up. It's the opposite of Barack Obama, who would be depleted at the end of the day.
And yet it is his need to keep moving, to do this job, that very well may be the death of our democracy. That is the fear.
It is the fear. It is also the limit of how far I think I am willing to try to read his psychology. Look, my job is to try to understand somebody's motives, to try to get inside their head. You know, look, he knows the risks. This is part of what's really looming here is this guy is a risk taker. He has been for a very, very long time. And sometimes it works out and sometimes it doesn't. That should be the more bracing fact than acknowledging that he is a guy who probably is afraid of retirement. I think that there is a way in which he has taken a colossal risk here. And what's strange about it is he doesn't actually have personal control of the outcome. You know who has control of the outcome? All of us. All of us. And so we have found ourselves, whether we like it or not, kind of handcuffed to this guy in this process that will ultimately determine the future of American politics.
He's gambled that we're going to show up.
Yeah. This is the good news. Honestly, is like, it can sound crazy to people that he's an optimist. It's not a cheap line. It's not a superficial assessment. He genuinely looks at the American public and he finds it utterly impossible to imagine that we would do things that would put Donald Trump back in office. He finds that so repellent to his image of this country. And I don't know whether he's right about that. I worry about that.
I don't know either. But I do know that the thing I want to hold as we leave is a bit of writing that you produced in the acknowledgments of your book, Wildland. Do you have a copy of it near you?
I do. Not because I'm a psychopath, but because they told me that you might do this. I want to just point that out.
Yeah, make sure you blame it on me. If you wouldn't mind, go to page 455, the very end.
Nobody nurtures my thinking more than Sarah Beth, whose energy, humor, and inexhaustible kindness are the fuel that powers our family. I started reporting this book before we had children. I'm finishing it in the company of Oliver and Rose. In between, I often oscillated between reasons to despair at our politics and occasions to rejoice at home. By the end, I was writing this book for them, in the wish that they might someday read of a time when their country lost sight of its moral ambitions, and I hope began the process of seeing them again. Oof, that is how I feel about this stuff. It feels intensely personal. It feels intensely personal.
And reading it, what part makes you emotional?
I think there's a way in which it feels as if the decisions we are making right now as people in public life and private life, people who cast votes, people who write about politics and think about politics, we think we're making decisions for ourselves. We're not. We're making decisions for people who don't even yet know that we're making it for them. Like my kids will inherit the world that we make now in our choices, and they are so grave. And I do sometimes look at my kids and they know that I write about politics. And, you know, I have this strange experience of trying to shelter them from the full reality of what it means to live in the era when somebody like Donald Trump is contending for power in this country. I don't tell them everything. I remember my daughter was 3. And when Trump lost, she said, Donald Trump lost the election because he didn't wear a mask. And I remember thinking, that's actually a pretty elegant simplicity to explaining what happened. But the reality is my kids are going to grow up in the world that all of us make for them. All of our kids are going to do that. And that is a kind of weighty burden. And it feels like this stuff matters beyond the superficial reality of politics at its most infuriating.
And today, in this moment, oscillating between despair and rejoice, where are you?
I'm willing to believe, actually, that we find it within ourselves to make the right choice. I am not willing by any means to relinquish that idea. I think that when the moment arrives, we won't subject ourselves and our descendants to the country that Donald Trump wants us to be.
Would you say the same thing to me if we weren't recording this?
100%. I'm an earnest person, which is kind of weird in the political world. You know, you're supposed to be cool and cynical. And I think it's probably why I've never really felt particularly at home in political writing. But I think maybe from that passage, you can tell that I kind of feel like cynicism is not an option now. It's not an option. The consequences are profound, and the people with the least power to defend themselves bear the most consequences for it. And for that reason, we don't have the luxury of looking away.
And I thank you for this entire conversation where we have done just about anything but look away. It is, it's meant a whole lot to me.
Thank you, Sam. It's a pleasure to talk to you, even when it's about hard things, and I'm grateful for the chance to do it.
Evan Osnos, until next time.
Talk to you then.
Small business owners, this one's for you. Chase for Business and iHeart bring you a new podcast series called The Unshakeables. This one-of-a-kind series will shine the spotlight on small business owners like you who faced a do-or-die moment that ultimately made their business what it is today. Join hosts Ben Walter, CEO of Chase for Business, and Tanya Nebo, a lawyer and business consultant, on these storytelling journeys of trials, tribulations, and triumphs that hinged on a single event, a split-second decision, or even a stroke of luck. Whether the story is about a warehouse going up in flames or a former partner stealing a whole roster of clients, each episode will showcase the grit, determination, and resourcefulness a small business owner needed to turn a pivotal situation into a springboard for success. Listen to The Unshakeables now and learn more at chase.com/business/podcast. Chase. Make more of what's yours. Chase Mobile App is available for select mobile devices. Message and data rates may apply. JPMorgan Chase Bank, N.A., member FDIC. Copyright 2024, JPMorgan Chase & Company.
The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. The PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with AI coaching tools and 5G connected cameras. AAA is getting more drivers back on the road fast with location telematics. And the Las Vegas Grand Prix is powering race day operations with 5G connectivity, giving fans an experience at the speed they deserve. This is accelerating innovation with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
Smart journalism. Fascinating topics. Words that describe CNN's podcast, The Assignment with Audie Cornish.
Last year, the Army missed its recruitment goal. It had 65,000 spots to fill and came up 10,000 short of that target. Why is it so hard to recruit? How's the Pentagon responding? And how are the voices of service members on social media shifting the balance?
Listen to The Assignment with Audie Cornish wherever you get your podcasts.
And that's our show. If you enjoyed today's episode, be sure to share it with a friend online, on social media. You can tag us at TalkEasyPod. Really, every little bit helps new listeners find the program. You can also leave a review on Spotify, Apple, wherever you like to listen. I also want to give a special thanks to our friends at The New Yorker, FSG Books, and Simon & Schuster, and of course, our guest, Evan Osnos. To read the books and pieces we talked about in this episode, visit our show notes at talkeasypod.com. For more episodes, I'd recommend our talks with Gloria Steinem, Maria Ressa, and David Remnick. To hear those and more Pushkin podcasts, listen on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you like to listen. You can also follow us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram at TalkEasyPod. If you want to purchase one of our mugs that come in cream or navy, or our vinyl record with Fran Lebowitz, you can do so at TalkEasyPod.com/shop. Talk Easy is produced by Caroline Reebok. Our executive producer is Janixa Bravo. Our associate producer is Caitlin Dryden. Today's talk was edited by Caitlin Dryden and mixed by Andrew Vastola. It was taped at Spotify Studios in Los Angeles, California. Our music is by Dylan Peck. Our illustrations are by Krisha Shenoy. Graphics are by Ethan Sinica. I also want to thank our team at Pushkin. Justin Richmond, Julia Barton, John Schnars, Carrie Brody, Eric Sandler, Kira Posey, Jordan McMillan, Tara Machado, Justine Lang, Sarah Nix, Malcolm Gladwell, Greta Kahn, and Jacob Weisberg. I'm Sam Fragoso. Thank you for listening to Talk Easy. Just a heads up, if you enjoy the show The Happiness Lab, our colleagues over there have a special episode coming your way to celebrate the World Happiness Day. That same episode will also be appearing in our feed this Wednesday, March 20th. As always, we'll be back with another episode the next Sunday. Until then, stay safe and so long.
Smart journalism. Fascinating topics. Words that describe CNN's podcast, The Assignment with Audie Cornish.
Last year, the Army missed its recruitment goal. It had 65,000 spots to fill and came up 10,000 short of that target. Why is it so hard to recruit? How's the Pentagon responding? And how are the voices of service members on social media shifting the balance?
Listen to The Assignment with Audie Cornish wherever you get your podcasts.